all, welcome back to Just a Bite. In this episode, I talk with two amazing partners the Ohio Association of Food Banks works with through the Ohio CAN program, funded through the USDA's Local Food Purchase Assistance Program. Jamie Pritchard joins us from Witt Farm, and Walt Bonham joins from the Food Lab and Richland Grow Up. We talk about the importance of local food systems, the historical context that makes it difficult for BIPOC farmers and other farmers left out of USDA programs to grow and scale, and how local farms are innovatively collaborating with one another to expand their reach and impact. Take a listen. Hi, Walt. Hi, Jamie. Thank you both for traveling to Columbus today and recording with us for this episode. I think it'll be a really good one. Let's start out by the two of you introducing yourselves. So could you share your name, what farm and co-op you're affiliated with, and how you got into farming?
My name is Walter Bonham. I am the owner of the Food Lab. I am a farmer and consultant, and I am a member, founding member of the Richland Grow Op, a cooperative in located in Mansfield, Ohio. I got interested in farming I knew some things that I wanted to do when I got older, but didn't know what I wanted to do now, about, you know, five, six years ago or so. And I just decided that, like, why am I waiting? Kind of took a approach of just deciding, you know, I was going to quit the corporate world and build my own business and try to pursue some things that I was passionate about, and took a bunch of classes around learning how to farm and food, just different things around food. Took some jobs that I treated like internship to kind of really introduce me into food and farming and catering road and so on. So it was a little bit of a process for me just coming out of out of the 9-to-5 world.
My name is Jamie Pritchard. I am the owner and operator of Witt Farm. I had a corporate job where I was just an office lady and decided, okay, I want to farm. So I just moved to the farm and I started farming and just figured it out as I went along, and then was able to go full time about 5 years ago.
That's awesome. I commend you both. I know that it is really difficult to go out on your own and start your own business, and especially in an industry that is so hard to get into and also, you know, operates on such small margins. So the Ohio Association of Food Banks, especially Carrie on our team, have developed a working relationship with you throughout the Ohio CAN program. Just a Bite actually highlighted this program last year when we interviewed Carrie and Ainsley from the Ohio Department of Agriculture. So we'll be sure to link that in our show notes for folks to listen after this episode. But this program has been funded through the USDA Local Food Purchase Assistance Program, which was established in 2022 and goes through June 30th of 2025. The Ohio CAN program aims to work with local farms that are BIPOC-owned, women-owned, veteran-owned, LGBTQ+-owned, small or beginner farms, and others that have been historically underserved and marginalized by USDA programs. This program allows food banks to purchase food from these farmers and develop relationships on an ongoing basis. We at the Ohio Association of Food Banks really love this program because it has allowed us to think differently about procurement and has allowed us to support farmers who we may not have otherwise because of how we have historically operated as food banks. How has this program been for you, and what good has come out of this partnership, and what can be improved as we push to make this more of a permanent program on the federal level?
The program has been absolutely fantastic. It's allowed me to do a lot more in other parts of my business, just from the aspect of having a lot more meat going out, so I can do more specialized things. Everyone that I've come in contact with, from Carrie to the food bank employees and everything, they've been wonderful.
Yeah, I think the program has been very beneficial for me. In our cooperative, currently right now too, I'm taking on a lot of sales work for our whole cooperative, and it's given us an opportunity to be able to recruit more, and we are looking to take on more farmers. It's allowed us to be open-minded about different items and things that we can grow. It's given us opportunity as a cooperative to get rid of items in bulk and in mass, which is very helpful. And then also it's provided some added opportunity for us to take some chances kind of going into next year and being diverse with our crop plan, challenging our farmers more, and actually giving our new recruits and new farmers and things some real opportunity too.
That's wonderful. Do either of you have any improvements that you think should be made? I know probably a big answer would be more permanent funding, but anything else or anything you want to expand on with that?
Yeah, honestly, for me, it's just if it's a permanent thing, that would be fantastic. Otherwise, I have no complaints. It's been just so wonderful.
Yeah, I really don't have any complaints at all either. I think it's been extremely beneficial for us to be able to sell the produce that we do in our community, and then also being able to sell to the food bank and see our produce donated to our community members and things too. So I'm very excited about it. And another huge thing that I like about it is our diversity to work with different food banks in our area. I think that's really a wonderful opportunity, and allows us to again be able to emphasize more on our recruiting and opening up new members to the possibilities of them growing and so on too.
Yeah, it's all about local farms, supporting local community, and then vice versa. So that's something that's really special about this, I think.
Yeah.
Can I potentially chime in with
yeah,
a question?
Of course.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you both talking about how the program has been for you. I know it's been a whirlwind. Jamie, you're the first person that I spoke to about this program before we even had the funding. She was so patient. My very eager friend introduced us, and at least 3 months before
we
had it. So, every time it's like, okay, it's coming. So, you both have been very patient with us in different ways. I was curious if you could go into a little bit more details on, just for maybe our audience who might not know exactly what do larger quantity orders do, for your business. So like Jamie, we're bringing a lot of like ground beef or ground mm-hmm. product, and then with like larger orders of value added products, how does that help you scale?
Well, one huge benefit with it also too is that we work with a diverse mix of farmers, and so some of our farmers have more land and property than others, and I think it allows us to be able to really pull from all of our farmers, and moving into next year we can actually crop plan for all of our farmers to be able to be a part of like larger loads and things and so on. So with us having a bunch of micro farms, we actually can get people to aggregate multiple pounds of vegetables together, so we can accumulate a 4,000 pound order or above and so on of certain vegetables. So that's one of the huge benefits of being able to have the larger orders. It allows everybody to participate in growing certain items that can all go on the truck together. And then also too, with the value added opportunity as well, we were able to plan to grow close to about 8,000 pounds of produce that could be dedicated just for value added. And that was huge for us. So that's another opportunity that allowed our farmers to be able to walk on their farm, be able to literally take beds, take high tunnels and say, hey, we got all this sold, this is going here, this is going there. And it really allows us to be able to give our farmers some reassurance in what we're doing and what we're selling to, on top of all of our local customers. So that's the other huge added benefit. It's like we are already having a lot of customers that we could sell to, and trying to diversify who we sold to, and then having another player come on board that can buy things in such bulk like that allows us to really expand ourselves.
Yeah, for me, it has given me the opportunity to hit a lifetime goal of supplying high-end restaurants. So right now I'm doing 12 hogs a month because I need 6 pork bellies a week for this high-end restaurant. Whereas before I just did not have an outlet for all of the other stuff. So now I can really work with big fluctuations where I will have somebody who wants all of my chuck rolls and my all of my T-bones and porterhouses, but then there's all of the brisket left over and some of the other parts of the beef that, because you guys are taking such a huge quantity of ground beef and pork sausage, you know, it doesn't matter if that restaurant switches over to rib roast and pork shoulders, because I can make anything into ground meat. So that has been phenomenal. And just knowing that I can budget ahead of time, I can schedule, that helps cash flow. That helps the whole figuring out what I'm doing next year and planning ahead instead of scrambling and being like, oh, I gotta find how I'm gonna do this. So it's been great.
I have been on a couple of farms when we had a tour with USDA up in the northern part of Ohio, and I kind of saw the value of the program in doing exactly what you guys are talking about, making sure that farmers are able to plan ahead and not have to worry necessarily as much about, you know, like, what if we have a bad crop year or whatever it may be, making sure that there's actual customers that can buy so much in bulk is helpful. So I'm glad to hear that's the same for you too. Many make assumptions, and agriculture is seen as white, male, and rural. It is also seen as intergenerational, where farmers learn farming from their parents and grandparents. It is also tied to large farms and big ag. However, this does not capture the diversity in farming. These assumptions are due to who has been systemically and intentionally left out of farming, and who has been historically encouraged to go into the profession by issuing loans to certain groups over others, by making land more accessible for certain groups over others, and other advantages. This is entrenched in racism, sexism, homophobia and transphobia, classism, and more. These barriers have not gone away. What else have you seen that is a deliberate policy choice?
In my opinion, I think that a lot of policies are just naturally focused on the way things have kind of always been traditionally done. It can kind of naturally kind of happen like that without people purposely paying attention to doing something different. And so with that being said, I think that it's kind of one of those things where we have to take charge and have to take a control of the narrative of how we are spreading out money, how we are spreading out opportunity. We have to take a better look at some barriers to entry and things, and then being able to also meet people where they're at. I think that farming is extremely difficult. If you're not already, you know, raised into farming and things, it can be, I can tell you firsthand, right? It can be a difficult field to kind of just kind of start off from scratch. There's a lot of things that are needed initially starting out the farming that create barriers to entry, such as land access, of course, financial access to money and loans and things to get you started and so on. So I think it's going to take a more of an effort to purposely pay attention to those who aren't represented so they can be represented, and then they can come to the table as well. And be able to farm appropriately and be able to farm in the same scale that traditional farmers are.
Yeah, totally agree with Walt, especially as a first generation farmer. And now, you know, I'm doing so much. There's so little time to get to the education about these things. So I know there's a lot out there about, you know, programs and free education and everything, but you have so little time to dedicate to that because you're, you know, top priority is finding customers and learning how to grow and raise things. And, you know, it would be great if somebody could just give you a little packet of here's the organization, their programs, and what they can do for you. You know, getting that out in front of new farmers is really what we're lacking. And then, again, to agree with you, is normalizing the diversity of what farmers really are now, because, you know, every tractor supply and truck commercial still all middle-aged white men. So just even in marketing, if we could normalize that more, it would be more in the forefront of people's minds.
Yeah. And I can definitely say, too, I'm very grateful. Part of my consulting work that I do, and where my farm is actually located, is with the North End Community Improvement Collaborative, the NECIC. And they actually have a 12-acre site that they are allowing people to be able to come on and train. That's where we all trained at, as a cooperative. And then also it gave us an opportunity to have farmland for us that didn't have land ourselves. So when I came into our cooperative and I started the program, I didn't even own a home, let alone being able to own any real space to be able to grow. And so by us all coming together and working with the NECIC, it allowed me and also a veteran-owned farmer and also a brand new business and a family-owned business to come actually on the farm, have a site, have a location, put our high tunnels there, share resources, share water, share knowledge, you know, and those type of things. So I think like the purpose intent of any like the NECIC to be able to host a space that can allow farmers to come on and learn and things like that from all walks of life and things is more of what we need. And then by having a program like this partnership with farmers, it gives them an opportunity to learn how to grow and to kind of get over that learning curve and things too that that it takes to actually become a farmer.
Those are great answers. I love your point, Walt, about, you know, farmers coming together and thinking of innovative solutions to some of these problems, although the problem is so huge and we all need to do something about it. But I love to see, you know, like farmers coming together and actually trying to do something about it to make their lives better and their communities better. So I thank you both for those great answers. The current supports or lack thereof make it hard to work in an industry that has such small margins and is so deeply impacted by external factors like extreme weather events for anyone, but especially difficult for folks who have been systemically pushed out of farming, like Black farmers, Indigenous farmers, and other farmers of color, as well as first-generation farmers, farmers who are LGBTQ+, and or women, and more. Is that consistent with what you have experienced? How has the lack of access and the lack of financial resources exacerbate a less diverse agriculture industry and community? And I know we kind of touched on this a little bit, but I'd love to hear more.
I feel like I've been somewhat lucky, but also have put myself in the situation of I don't get that very much because I don't surround myself with those kind of people. You know, I do get those comments sometimes of, you know, woman farmer, and even had a bunch of guys say, oh, can you back your trailer in here? And I did it just fine. And then, you know, then it was all great. But, you know, they see a woman and automatically I can't drive a truck or back up a trailer. But I don't engage with those people. I don't surround myself with those people. So, you know, I do have a farmer that I collaborate with who is exactly what you think. He is middle-aged, he's white, he's straight, he's seventh generation. So he is like the poster boy for farmers. But he doesn't look to me as anything other than an equal. He asked me for advice. He provides advice. He, you know, instead of talking to my dad or my husband who is with me, he talks to me as the farmer. So some of that is surrounding yourself with those people.
Yes. I would say in my experience, talking to other farmers, since I started farming, whether it's at, you know, different conferences or different farm visits and things, and then even through some of my recruiting and even some of our members that have showed interest or been a part of our cooperative throughout the years, I think I've heard a bunch of different stories and different struggles and different challenges. And I think that's kind of one of the things that that I appreciate about the Richland Grow Up in our cooperative is that we do meet people where they're at. And so we all started 10 people who had never farmed before. from completely different walks of life. So, you know, through that process, I was able to see a lot of what we're talking about and discussing and things. And then from meeting other farmers at OFA conferences and just different things and so on that that go through these struggles. And it is very real. I think that it can't be generalized either. I think that a lot of these folks from these different walks of life and backgrounds have their own individual stories and their own individual struggles and things like that. Our cooperative is very diverse. We are pretty much a woman-owned cooperative with our number of farmers and things that we've had over the years and that we've taken on and things too. So I think that it's something that's very present still. And I think there's not a one blanket answer to solving some of these things, as much as it is that we have to meet farmers where they're at on their individual levels, and then kind of take them along the way to help them be successful overall.
Absolutely, thank you both. What barriers have made it difficult as a small to mid-sized farm and/or co-op?
Well, there's a huge learning curve, of course. That comes into farming, and I think that can't be overstated enough. I joke around about that it's not like playing the piano or anything, right? If I want to learn how to play the piano, I can practice that like every day until my fingers get sore. But you know, learning how to grow crops, I get like that one season, or I get a couple tries at it per year, and then you literally have to wait, you know, a whole another year in season to get started. So I think that one of the most difficult challenges and things has been, you know, the learning curve. As far as a cooperative and things, it's operating all together with a bunch of strangers and things that can be, you know, extremely difficult. Some of the aggregation stuff gets extremely hard and things too. You know, you got to really count on people to bring in, you know, the produce that they're supposed to be growing and so on too. And I would say that another big challenge too would be, well, it kind of was, it's like, you know, really finding those markets and things. Because when you're in a cooperative and all of us are growing, and the cooperative exists just solely to sell produce for the farmers, it does create those challenges. And when you do that work out there yourself, you don't want to be calling produce, or you don't want to see produce not get sold and things too. So those are some of the biggest challenges.
Yeah, I would say scaling and cash flow. There is, you know, it's almost like every farm has the same kind of journey where you start and you sell a few things and then you're addicted. Like you immediately know this is the rest of your life and this is, you're never going to get over it. And there's just a point in that journey where it is a big struggle because, you know, for instance, I've doubled my business every year for the last 5 years. And at first it's very easy because I'm making, you know, a few thousand dollars, you know, it's not a big stretch to add more. But for example, just a few weeks ago, I had my butcher call and say, hey, I have an extra 15 dates in December, which I can never get any in December. So I have to jump on that. Well, that's over $10,000 to buy the pigs, to do the butchering, to do all of that. But I don't get paid for another 2 months because, you know, it's got to hang and it's got to be processed and butchered and packaged. And then I get it. I have to do all of my things and then it's delivered. And then, you know, most of my accounts are net 30. So you just don't have tens of thousands of dollars just laying around to jump on an opportunity. But if you want to grow, you have to. So for me, you know, I was also leasing land for the first 5 years and just last year bought our first farm. That's a huge chunk of money that if you don't have the revenue coming in, you know, it's a balancing act for sure. Yeah, that's, to me, those are the biggest barriers.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to talk about how farmers have worked really innovatively and collaboratively to kind of address some of these problems. So, well, I was wondering, how do co-ops better set farmers up for success to access programs like Ohio Can? And how can co-ops help smaller farmers sell together?
I think one of the biggest things is sharing resources, sharing knowledge. One thing about our cooperative is, you know, we provide crop plans, we provide auditing, audits and things to help you write on farm, any consulting work to help you get set up. We provide seeds and transplants, boxes and bags. We provide the kitchen space, right? We rent the kitchen space out for all the members and so on. So there's a lot of benefits that come with congregating and coming together that is just basically sharing costs, sharing responsibilities, and also to just kind of lowering some of the demands that you would have on yourself as an individual farmer by allowing people to work for you as a farmer in a cooperative.
Maybe some of the things that you don't necessarily think about, like a farmer having to do or having to have on hand in order to make sure that they can sell and bring their product to market.
Yeah, with our farmers, you know, we count on them to grow the best product they can, the best produce they can, and get it to the refrigerator. And once it gets to the refrigerator, then the cooperative handles it from there. So they don't have to worry about where it's going, how much goes to who, breaking down any poundages into smaller bags or any of that type of stuff. It's literally dropping in the computer, entering in your drop-off information, and then the cooperative will take it over from there. And then 30 days later, you get your check. So we try to make it really simple for the farmers because, you know, no running around the farmer's markets, no hassle about selling and things, you know, no hassles about what you should grow and where it's going to go and all those type of things. We try to just eliminate a lot of that stress for the farmer.
Land has come up a few times. And, you know, well, I was curious if you could talk a little bit about, like, specifically a co-op model. How does that creatively think of solutions to barriers to land access? You know, what size farms, you know, are part of your cooperative, and, you know, how is it different from them, you know, working on their own in terms of what they can grow versus like with everyone collective?
We have farms as small as around about 5,000 square feet. That's probably like around our smallest farms. That's what we actually consider a micro farm. And so with our cooperative and our approach was to create a bunch of micro farms and small farmers and get people into farming as a secondary source of income. We wanted people to continue to have their normal lives, whether they were, you know, teachers. We have a dentist farmer. We have, you know, just your known-to-five farmers and so on. They can maintain their job and things and still be able to have a separate business and being able to farm and things. So by coming together as a cooperative and collective, people could even farm in their backyards, right? So some of our farms are even homestead farms. Some people farming on their own land and things. And then we have a few of us that are farming off-site. By coming together as a cooperative, it has allowed some of our members to even expand their locations. And so we have one farmer, he takes on about like five different locations. And he literally goes around, you know, multiple places and farms throughout the day and aggregates things and brings it all back. So like when you see traditionally, you know, a farmer farming on one large piece of land, you know, we definitely do it a lot different in our cooperative model. And again, that's part of meeting people where they're at, with the land that they do have, and then actually providing space for people to be able to take a chance at growing.
And I know, Jamie, you do not belong to a co-op, but I know that you work with other farmers collaboratively. So how do farmers find kind of innovative and cooperative solutions to problems, even when not formally working together?
In that kind of farming journey, you realize you can't do it all, that there is no one farm that does it all. You start networking and talking to farmers that you know and other vendors at the farmers market. For example, I have a local feed farmer, so he grows all the grain and mills the feed for us. And he also has his own, you know, meat farm, and he does beef. Beef is not something I've been able to do, because not enough land. It's a two-year process, so it is a big chunk of money for a return 2 years later, which is very hard. So he approached me about selling his like beef sticks and jerky, so value add stuff, and I said, yeah, I'd love to. And then I came back and said, well, what if I just start buying a half a beef a month at your, you know, bulk beef price, and I will do a retail. And it has worked out so well. I'm up to two beef a month now. but I certainly don't have space for, you know, 50 beef on my farm. So I think we'll just continue for a while, you know, and it's phenomenal beef. It is really, really good beef. So it has worked out really well. So now I also have an egg farmer where I do duck eggs sometimes, but I just don't want 100 hens. He's got all of this excess. And so through winter, I'm clearing out everything he's got. And then through summer, I will just be doing like a egg CSA. So yeah, it's worked out really well to work with other farmers.
I was just kind of thinking about, like, you know, when you're talking about how, like, being a co-op and, like, all the different, you know, meeting people where they're at in terms of, like, the land they have and, like, the micro farms. I was also just kind of thinking about it, too, like, earlier when we're talking about, like, what the idea is of a farmer. It's typically, like, rural. And Walt, you know, the Richland Grow Up is in Mansfield. It's in a more, like, urban area. And, yeah, I just think, like, this idea of a co-op kind of really is, like, a really great solution for farmers in, like, urban areas especially, and just kind of, you know, there's so much land out there, vacant land out there, and even though there's just kind of really small pockets everywhere that doesn't really look farmable, like, changing this idea of farming into we can have 5,000 square foot micro farms and together that forms a, you know, a viable network of, you know, really good quality product that can be distributed to in like large amounts to the food banks or to restaurants and stuff. So yeah, I don't know if either of you have any thoughts on that, or I would love to hear more about kind of what you see as that being a solution to like urban farms.
Yeah, I think it's really cool that the NECIC's urban farm site location has four farms on it. And so four micro farms on it. And so the NECIC houses three of those farms, and then they are able to lease them out on top of them running the farm themselves, and then my farm is there. So one of the beautiful things about that site is that it was a former brownfield. It was actually the former location of one of Mansfield's most famous companies, Gorman Rupp, that is actually a billion dollar company, started right there where we were farming at, and now they're international now, and that lot has been sitting vacant for, you know, like about a decade. And so so just like you were saying, being able to actually take a former space that was very popular in our community and then turn it into now another space that has become popular in our community has been huge. And also the start of another new business. A couple of our farmers who have purchased lots from the land bank, right? So one of our farmers, her homestead farm is right next to her house off of five lots that she purchased from the land bank, and that's over time. She didn't get them all at once, and so on. And then she was able to transform her area into a beautiful property. And then the other farmer that I spoke of, who has multiple lots and things too, he bought all of those off of the land bank. And it's really cool to see, you know, these high tunnels start popping up everywhere, you know, in the inner city. It's even has led to us being able to create farming programs at my old middle school and my old high school, where I was able to build farms at right in the inner city. And another huge point that I didn't make is that our cooperative is actually made up of both, right? So we have rural and urban farmers in our cooperative. So that's one of the kind of cool things that you see, is like you see both kind of coming together and working together to try to for the same common goal too.
Like, well, I feel like the bridging of the rural and urban divide is like something that we're seeing a lot more as we're reimagining farming and what it could look like. Yeah. I had a question. Piggyback with you, Jamie. So I believe you've worked with like Shared Legacy Farm with some marketing and, mm-hmm. you know, thinking through those strategies. Are you able to share a little bit more on, you know, I feel like everyone expects a farmer to, you know, they're managing their business. They're not only farming, they're doing the books, they're doing the marketing, they're doing everything. You're driving, always driving. Can you share a little bit about, you know, what that experience was like, and, you know, how that shared knowledge of some other skills, you know, can look like with between farmers?
Yeah, so actually, Corinna, who is one of the farmers at Shared Legacy Farms, she has an amazing podcast that you can learn so much about farm marketing. So she has a very large CSA, and that's her bulk of her work. You can put what she's teaching to any kind of farming, any kind of direct-to-consumer farming. She also runs a marketing group coaching school, which I am a part of and have been since the beginning, and it is the most fantastic thing. So we have everything from, you know, a lot of us are meat farmers. Some of us are vegetable and meat farmers. There's a community-supported fishery from San Francisco that's in there. It's like this amazing mind bank of all of this information, and everyone is so willing to say, you know, this is what I did, this is what worked for me, this is what didn't work for me. You know, in this school, every month we have a big project, and she kind of teaches us, you know, the first session is kind of the basics of marketing, and then we get into the details, and you know, we redid our website homepage and email marketing challenges and stuff. And just, I can't say enough good things about Corinna, Shared Legacy Farm, and the whole kind of podcast and marketing school she does.
That's awesome. I know that you as farmers are doing your part, making sure you're spreading the word and, you know, creating solutions for you and your farms and your cooperatives wherever you can. I know that a lot of these issues are really systemic and large, meaning that they really need solutions that match the problem. I was curious, what solutions do you think would benefit you and your farm and co-op? And I know we've kind of threaded that throughout, but I'm curious if you have any other thoughts.
So going back to my kind of barriers of scalability and cash flow, you know, grants and free grant writing resources, you know, I've tried writing one grant once and it obviously didn't get it because I was very new at the time and didn't know what I was talking about. But again, I am so busy because I am doing all of the things, and like driving is 85% of what I do, which is horrible. But I think that could go a long way. So this whole program is based on a grant, and it has been a game changer for my farm. So, you know, it doesn't just have to be directly for farmers, but, you know, co-ops, food banks, you know, anywhere in the farming system is really helpful.
I think one of the biggest solutions to help us kind of overall is we need good food to be incentivized. Terrible food is highly incentivized. Growing food for everything but eating it is incentivized. And growing food for, you know, oil production and whatever else is incentivized. And so it's actually kind of weird sometimes when, like, you will see a grant or you see something that's, like, focused on providing healthier alternatives or providing local produce or providing, they say, like, you know, good produce or good food. Or I'm like, well, what is all the other stuff, you know? It kind of makes you think, you know, and wonder, like why isn't this focused on enough? So I think programs like this, you know, that are purposely, you know, incentivizing the proper efforts, the proper work being done amongst, you know, underrepresented, you know, folks and farmers, does a lot of that representation that we need. You know, you gotta be mindful and meaningful about what you're doing and who you're trying to help and how you're trying to help them and things too. So I think if one thing that we can do overall that would just help our whole systems, from the top down, meat farmers, the food banks, the aggregation locations, and everybody, is looking at and demanding more incentives be placed around some of the work that we do directly. Like, why aren't more high schools and more daycares and more government agencies and things been incentivized to use, you know, more local produce or organic produce or from underrepresented farmers and things like that. So I think if we were able to create incentives, there's tax incentives for everything else, right? When you start lowering taxes and things, people start moving and companies start changing their policies and behaviors and things like that. So I think if we can create some emphasis around that, we can be, again, directly intentional on who we're helping, why we're helping them, and what we're doing. And then we can see the change in the income change too.
was just so well put. And one really different thing about this grant was that it's incentivized to pay market rate, which is a very different world for, you know, food banks and, you know, I'd say a lot of institutional spaces. Can you, and both of you feel free to answer this, share why that's important? Like, you know, not just bringing in, you know, local food, but also paying farmers a fair wage.
For me, it has allowed me to get more equipment. It's allowed me to hire another person so that I can sleep more than, you know, 3 hours a night, and I can, you know, sit and actually eat a meal for all these people that I'm feeding. I never get to eat. It's horrible. But yeah, when we are being asked to bring our prices down so low to match giant corporations, we're doing the work for free. It's again, back to the scalability thing. I don't have the equipment that large corporations have. I don't have the staff that they have. It gets to the point where I'm doing the work for free, and that's not sustainable for anybody.
I would say it makes a huge difference for us as a cooperative, because through selling our produce and things, I've really learned that I completely stopped trying to sell to people who I even had to compete with price, because I can't, right? The way we work, our processes, we don't have large farmer equipment and things. We don't have, you know, huge John Deere's and different equipment doing work for us and so on. And then a lot of us, you know, we hire different summer help and different things and so on, but it is a lot of the farmers themselves, you know, taking on a lot of the work. So, and then also through having a cooperative, the cooperative has to be sustainable too. So the cooperative has to take a percentage of the produce sales to operate for the farmers. By capturing the true cost on what we should be paid for our produce allows us to regulate things better for our farmers and be more sustainable as a business. I think that that's another huge thing around we could look at policy-wise, is that the true food cost isn't truly captured in the different things that people are buying from the grocery store. And if it was, you know, then we could definitely compete, you know, more with some of those local prices and things too, because people wonder why food is so expensive, but they don't wonder why it's so cheap. And if they were able to just take a second to even look into why food was so cheap, then, you know, then they could maybe appreciate paying a little bit more from buying stuff from local farmers. And then also, too, and along the same lines, it's like when we talk about policy changes and different things, too, and in these different focuses, we don't focus on food miles. You know, wouldn't it be really cool if we could, like, focus on food miles and the shorter distance that you purchase your food, you know, the great incentives you can have and different things like that would be, you know, very beneficial too.
Great question and great answers. I think that leads us right into our next question, especially to your point about how cheap things are at the grocery store compared to the local food landscape. And people get upset when they see how much local food costs, but don't really consider what goes into all of that. So how can listeners do their part? I'm sure shopping local, shopping intentionally, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
Gotcha. Well, I'm definitely going to say visit all your local farmers markets, right? All your local all small business stores and things. And I just would say that overall, you know, like, I get it. You know, you can't necessarily go to a farm or a farmer necessarily get maybe everything you need. But I think you can make a vote with your dollars and with your energy and what you continue to make consistent within your buying habits and different things. So, I mean, that's what I would just really encourage listeners and people to do, is to kind of challenge yourself to go outside the norm and, you know, visit those local small spots, visit those farmers and things, and then, you know, go purchase whatever else you couldn't get and so on. And I think by doing that first too, you can maybe create some incentives around maybe even changing your eating habits, paying attention more to what you eat, paying attention more to what you're doing and things, getting connected with other farmers who may have, you know, the produce and things and different items that you're looking for. So yeah, I would say just, you know, really just get in contact with your local farmer somewhere.
Yeah, and I would say even beyond shopping with your local farmer, engage. Sign up for the newsletter, get on their Instagram, Facebook, whatever it is. You know, share the food that you're buying. tell the person, hey, I got this meat from Whit Farm, or I got this produce from wherever. Just normalizing local food will just catapult us into, you know, that's the normal. You know, that's it's easier to go to the farmer's market because you can still get everything except for the paper towels and paper plates that nobody should use anyways. But, you know, word of mouth is the first step to success on a farm. Realize that it doesn't have to stop with you, and it doesn't have to stop with your family. It can, you know, that's how I got my first high-end restaurant, is because one of my loyal customers said something. And, you know, that's how I met Carrie, is through another farmer's market vendor, is because he said something to me about this. So yeah, just talk constantly about local farms.
Yeah, and go visit. I like that too. Yeah. You know, yeah, go visit. That can be a huge experience. One thing I do notice, that we actually have a farmer's market that is located actually at the urban farm too, right on farm. So a lot of times people get tours and things, and I think it could be really, it's really eye-opening to folks to kind of see this stuff grow and kind of see some of the process and things too. And that can impart on the changes in your life as far as, you know, what decisions you make and things too, by just really getting into the experience of seeing what farmers do.
Yeah. So many people just like don't even think about the fact that their food actually grows in the ground or right. sometimes, or it's like comes from, you know, an animal that's being fed for months and months.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. It's really kind of a cool thing to actually have people embrace their ignorance at the farm. So like people are walking around and have like no clue what they're looking at and anything, but the stuff that they eat, you know, and so on. So I think that's, you know, that's really cool, just embracing the ignorance and challenging themselves to think differently.
Great points. I want to end on what brings you hope. I know that it can be really easy to focus on the day-to-day or focus on the challenges, but I'm sure there are some good things and things you're looking forward to.
Gosh, I would say what really gives me hope is really continuing to like expand on all this stuff. Looking at where I started, you know, where I started, and then where I'm going, and where I'm at now, and where I'm going. You know, it gives me hope to just continue to expand to diversify ourselves more, for us to see, you know, our food going different places and even out of state and even out of Ohio. You know, really inspires me. So I just want to continue to do more expanding and more growing and allow us to continue to diversify ourselves even more.
Hands down, the people, you know, everybody from customers to chefs, food bank employees, butchers, hatchery staff, friends and family that eat what we produce. You know, without them, none of this is possible. You know, I would have, I don't know, an acre of just meat sitting around if there was nobody to eat it. So, you know, really the people have been just great.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both for talking to me and the team at OAF and ODA. Could you share where the listeners can find you? Feel free to promote your website, social media, wherever.
Yeah. So my website is witfarm.com. So it is WITFARM.com. And then Instagram, Facebook, whatever is at witfarmoh. So WITFARMOH.
And you can reach our cooperative. Our website is richlandgrowop.com. So it's Richland, then GRO-OP. And then that's the same attack for our Facebook. Also, too, you can come visit where I farm at, and our local nonprofit, the North End Community Improvement Collaborative. That's at 311 Bowman Street, Mansfield, Ohio. And their website, necic-ohio.org. You can find out a little more about what we do down there also.
I want to thank Jamie and Walt for chatting with me about this. I hope you found it informative. Check out the show notes to learn more about Jamie and Walt and their farms. If you are local to them, I encourage you to support their businesses and buy their product.
Thanks all. We'll talk to you in early 2024.